1 Corinthians 11:7 through 11:10, the 31st talk in a series on 1 Corinthians, was presented by Ron Julian on November 30, 2003 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Well, good morning. I want to give you that warning that I've been giving all along, that this is a very difficult passage, and I don't claim to be speaking dogmatically about how to understand it. I'm going to try to tell you what I understand at this point and leave you to sort it out for yourself. We're in 1 Corinthians 11, talking about head coverings and other such things. I tried to paint a picture last time that the cultural background for this passage, which is very important, is also very spotty and ambiguous. It's difficult to put together a coherent picture of exactly what was going on in the culture at the time regarding head coverings. Today, what I want to do is try to, if I can, bring some clarity to what I think is the central part of what Paul's saying here, the part that's most significant to us. It's challenging to understand exactly what he's doing, and I see my job here today as to explain to you as best I can what I see as the potential for what he's doing anyway, and yet acknowledge at the same time that there are difficult questions involved. The part I want to concentrate on this morning starts in verse 7, where he says, "For a man ought not to have his head covered, since he is the image and glory of God, but the woman is the glory of man. For man does not originate from woman, but woman from man. For indeed man was not created for the woman's sake, but woman for the man's sake. Therefore, the woman ought to have a symbol of authority on her head because of the angels." And I was reading from the New American Standard there, I think. Okay, so he starts out this section by saying that a man ought not have his head covered since he is the image of glory, image and glory of God. And we talked last time about the difficulties in sorting out why culturally a man having something on his head while he prayed would have communicated something that was inappropriate. But nonetheless, he argues here that it is because the man is the image and glory of God that it is inappropriate that he wear a head covering that would send the wrong message. However, he's saying, there is a difference in the woman's situation. The woman is the glory of man. Now again, as I argued last time, I think what he has to be saying is that for the man, there is one consideration. He is a human being made in the image and glory of God. And for Paul, it is self-evident, if you read Genesis, that man and woman alike are made in the image of God. That's explicitly the way the passage reads. And the point of the story, I think, as it comes together, is clearly designed to say that man and woman are made of the same stuff, are both human beings, both made in the image of God. But the woman has a consideration that the man does not, I would say that he's arguing. The man only has to consider that he is the image and glory of God. But the woman has the further consideration that she is the glory of the man. And he makes that defense by appealing to Genesis, basically, by saying that the woman was made from the man and she was made on his account. I think this is the key to his whole argument. This is the part that we're most interested, basically, theologically. We would like to know what is he saying here about men and women based on Genesis. And it is also difficult to sort out, as I said. The structure of his argument, I think, is like this. Woman is the glory of man, and then he gives a defense of that idea. Woman was made from man and not the other way around. And likewise, woman was made on account of man and not the other way around. And because that's an explanation for the fact that the woman is the glory of the man, I think we would understand his argument to be saying the woman is the glory of the man and not the other way around. So there is this strong lack of symmetry at this particular point in the relationship between men and women. He is very explicit in saying that she is from him and not otherwise, not the other way around. He is not from her. And she was made on his account, and he was not made on her account. So that's the part that we want to try to understand. What is it that accounts for that lack of symmetry, and what does he mean by it? What is the significance of it? Now, it seems to me that the fact that we have this lack of symmetry is important in trying to understand what he's saying. Suppose, for the sake of argument, that head covering had exactly the same sort of implication, symbolic value that a wedding ring has. It just said, this is a married woman, and that's all that it meant. Paul might say something like, I mean, it's hard to imagine how this would be the case, but don't take your wedding ring off in the worship service. Okay, I mean, you just have to bear with me here. The thing about it is, that's a symmetrical cultural symbol to us. The woman wearing a wedding ring means the same thing that a man wearing a wedding ring does. And he could equally say to the man, you shouldn't take your wedding ring off in the middle of the worship service, because if there was a symbolic message being sent by taking off your wedding ring, the woman and the man would be sending the same message, and it would be the same problem. Each of them is supposed to be faithful to the other. Each of them has joined together with that other person. So what's striking to me is that whatever the significance of the head coverings is here, Paul is arguing not just that it's inappropriate for the woman to send that message, but it is based on something that is true about her that is not true about the man. And that's the challenge of this. He wants to argue that whatever the cultural symbolism is of wearing something on your head, that the reason that the woman ought to do it is because there's something different about her situation than about the man's situation. And that's the part that's challenging to understand. What is exactly that difference, and how do we put it together? And his basic argument is the reason that she should not take her head covering off and send whatever that inappropriate message is because she is his glory. So, in order to understand what Paul's getting at here, we're going to have to go back and look at Genesis a little bit, because that's what he's appealing to. This thing that the woman is made from the man and on account of the man, I think finds its roots in the story of Adam and Eve, the story of the first man and the first woman. So, I'm going to jump us into Genesis chapter 2, starting in verse 15. Then the Lord God took the man and put him into the Garden of Eden to cultivate it and keep it. And the Lord God commanded the man, saying, from any tree of the garden you may eat freely, but from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat from it you shall surely die. Then the Lord God said, it is not good for the man to be alone. I will make a helper suitable for him. And out of the ground the Lord God formed every beast of the field and every bird of the sky, and brought them to the man to see what he would call them. And whatever the man called a living creature, that was its name. And the man gave names to all the cattle, and to the birds of the sky, and to every beast of the field. But for Adam there was not found a helper suitable for him. So the Lord God caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man, and he slept. Then he took one of his ribs and closed up the flesh at that place, and the Lord God fashioned into a woman the rib which he had taken from the man, and brought her to the man. And the man said, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman, because she was taken out of man. For this cause a man shall leave his father and his mother, and shall cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And the man and his wife were both naked and were not ashamed. Okay, this is the story, as I understand it, that has led to Paul making this comment. Let me articulate a little bit of what I see there. Adam, the man, is made first on his own, And he is given a task to keep the garden, and he is given a command to obey. God then says, it is not good for the man to be alone. I want to make a helper suitable for him. And we're going to talk about that phrase here in a minute. And then God does it in an interesting way. He brings all of the animals before Adam, and he has them named by Adam. Adam, you look at those animals, think about those animals, and give them names. And one suspects that, you know, the kinds of names we're talking about is, you know, giraffe gets creature with a long neck and, you know, that kind of thing. Because he's looking at them and figuring out what sort of a thing is this. In the process, he comes to see that there is no helper suitable for him. Presumably, he sees the animals pairing off, male and female. But there is no one there for him. There is this gap between the animals and himself. In looking at them all, he recognizes that all of them are on one side of something that he is on the other side of. They're not his helper. Having recognized that there is no helper suitable for him, then God creates the woman from his rib. When he sees her, then Adam looks at her and says, "This now, aha, this is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh." And she'll be called woman because she was taken from man. The idea being that he has named all the animals. Now when he sees a woman, he recognizes this is someone who is like me. Bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. Unlike all the animals I have seen, this is someone that corresponds to me. And then, just as he names the animals, he gives her a name. And if I understand what's happening, he has basically given a feminine form of the name for a guy. There's a male guy and a female guy, if you follow me. So, where then in this story is the lack of symmetry that Paul is talking about? Well, it's clear that Adam is made first, and in fact, Paul appeals to that fact in another passage in Timothy when he talks about this event. He says it that way specifically. Adam was made first. We can see that Eve was made from Adam and not the other way around. I mean, Adam was created first and Eve was a rib taken from his side and then made into a woman. So she was made from him. He was not made from her. And we might say that one of the most significant statements that might imply some sort of lack of symmetry is he needed a helper suitable to him, and she was created to be that helper suitable to him. Now, there are those who would deny that the phrase a helper suitable to him implies the lack of symmetry that we see in what Paul's talking about. Yes, clearly there is a difference in order. Adam came first, but so what? The argument would go. I mean, why does that make him any more important or make him the boss or give him any sort of priority where the woman ought to support, to be submissive to him? And, you know, of course, people make the argument, well, you know, Adam was made out of the ground, so does that mean that the ground is the boss and Adam has to do what the ground says? What does it matter? Who came first and who was made from whom? I comfort myself in thinking, however uncomfortable it is for me to talk, it's probably more uncomfortable for you to listen. So, okay. So, all I have to do is wait for my eyes to stop watering, and then I'll be able to read this. Where are we here? Okay, so what's the big deal? So, when it comes to that phrase, a helper suitable to him, there are two arguments that are made, often made on the side from those who would argue that this does not imply any sort of lack of symmetry, any sort of priority or authority or anything like that when it comes to the man. First of all, the phrase suitable to him, this Hebrew phrase is ezer kenegdo, helper suitable for him, equivalent to him, corresponding to him. People argue different things. But some argue that the way we ought to understand that phrase is equal. It is a helper equal to him. And that being the case, then, it is obviously inappropriate to conclude that there is any sort of priority or subordination involved in this relationship, because if she's equal to him, then that implies that there is no difference in their roles or functions or anything like that. Well, that doesn't seem to me to be a very good argument, because it seems clear in the context what the phrase konegdo is meant to communicate. The whole story is about how there is no helper equivalent to him. That is, there is no human being. He is alone. All the other animals have mates, but he has none. He looks at all the animals and he recognizes there is none of them are a helper equivalent to me. None of them is like me. And so, having learned that, then, God makes the woman, and when he looks at her, he says, aha, this is bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. And I would argue essentially what he's saying is, this is one who is konegdo, or konegdi, actually, is like me. This now is someone, all those animals do not correspond to me. I don't match with them. But with this one, I do. This one, I can see that I am meant for her and she's meant for me in that sense. We are human beings. So I think the significance of konegdo here clearly does, it is intended to communicate equality of a certain kind. But in the context, the equality it is intended to communicate is equality of being, equality of essence. She is a human being as I am. Therefore, in the context of Genesis, where we speak of mankind being made in the image of God, we see here woman being made from man, so she too is a human being made in the image of God. So it is true that this is intended to communicate a great equivalence between the man and the woman, the fact that she's made from him, and that she alone is corresponding to him in a way that no one else is. It is a great message of the equality of man and woman in the sense that they are both carriers of the dignity of being human beings made in the image of God. But it doesn't by itself imply anything about the roles that they're intended to fill. They're, just as she is konegdo, like him in some ways, it is also clear that she is not like him in other ways. And so the phrase cannot be pushed to say there is no difference between them. We have to understand it in the context to mean what Genesis is obviously getting at, which is, unlike the animals, she is a human being like himself. Okay, now, the even stronger argument that you will find people make from this phrase, azer konegdo, a helper corresponding to him or something like that, concentrates on the word helper, because it is true that if you go and look at the way the word helper is used throughout the Old Testament, there are a number of places where God is referred to as our helper. God is the helper of Israel. God is the helper of the one who calls on him, and that sort of thing. And so the argument is made, well, the word helper doesn't imply subordination of any kind then, because obviously we are not subordinate to God. God is greater than we are, and yet he is our helper. Therefore, to be a helper does not imply any sort of subordination or priority on the part of the one who's being helped. Well, that up to a point, that argument sounds good, but I think that the point that Jack has made here is a helpful one. He makes the analogy that if you think about a parent helping a child with their math homework. Yes, the parent is the superior in that relationship. The child has an obligation to submit to the parent, that it doesn't go the other way around. And it's also true that the parent is superior to the child in skill at mathematics. That's why the parent is helping with the math. I mean, presumably, this is not always the case, I know, but we're supposing in theory, in this situation, that the parent is superior to the child in math, and that's why they're helping them. Okay, but the point that Jack makes that I think is very relevant is if you think about that situation, it is still true that whose responsibility is it to do the math homework? It is the kid's responsibility, not the parent. The kid is the one who's going to get the grade on it, not the parent. And so in that situation, there would be something a little bit inappropriate for a parent to force a kid to put down an answer that the kid thought was wrong, because the parent is not going to get the grade for this thing. It is the kid that's going to get the grade for it in the end. So I think that we could say that that particular lack of symmetry holds even in the relationship of God and those he helps. It's true that God is the master, and it's true that God is more powerful and more capable. But if I ask him, for instance, to help me avoid sin, the fact is it is my life that needs to avoid sin. It is my responsibility to avoid sin. If I'm asking me to help him, I'm not saying it's your responsibility that I don't sin. It is my responsibility, and I'm asking you to help. I want you to help me fulfill my responsibility to do what is right instead of what is wrong. So it seems with that sort of picture then that that would be true of any sort of helper, and the fact it could be true as well as we understand what's happening in Genesis. The story clearly communicates the equality in human dignity between men and women. And it also implies, I think, a superiority of women in those areas where they are most called upon to help. That is, it would be foolish for God to create someone inferior to the man and say, here's your helper. I mean, what? Thanks. You know, I think I could have done it myself, actually. I mean, clearly, the very fact that the woman is called upon to help means that she is capable and, in fact, probably better suited for those things that she is most called upon to help with than the man is. And I have said many times, and I think many would concur with me about this, it seems to me that part of what marriage is about is the parties involved learning to respect the differences on the other side. And for men, I think part of what marriage is meant to teach us is to learn a respect for the wife in particular and recognizing her superiority in many ways to the man. I mean, that was something, as I've said this many times, but that's something that I had to go through. I was very presumptuous when we got married. And I just sort of had this idea that the way I thought about everything was the right way to think about everything. And my wife sure was lucky to be married to me so I could straighten her out on that stuff. I never said anything like that. And I don't, if you had asked me if I thought that, I would have said, oh no, I don't think that. But I say that now because I recognize what happened to me in the process of marriage, where I started to recognize the difference in my wife and the way that in many ways she is more suited to make various aspects of our marriage work than I am. And for the project that we have taken on together, she provides something that I cannot provide, and if she were not there, it would be sorely missing in my life project. And all of you know Robbie, so you know that's true. So the fact is that to be a helper does not imply inferiority. But it seems to me it still can imply that when you look at the situation, the fact is that the one who is the one helping the one who has the job. It is the man's task fundamentally, and she has been made to help. That, if that is what Paul is seeing in Genesis, then that would be a genuine lack of symmetry. Equality and dignity, superiority in some abilities and capabilities in life, but a helper to the man who has been called to a certain thing. Now, that brings us then to the idea of glory. Because Paul is saying it is the fact that she is made from him and on his account that she is his glory. What are we going to make of that? Well, I start by noticing that the word glory often implies something like honor. When it was used in that culture, when it was used in the New Testament, certainly, something like honor is often what is being talked about. And I notice that we could say throughout 1 Corinthians 11 that we have a kind of a pairing of opposites of shame and dishonor on the one side and glory on the other. The man should not shame his head. He is the glory of God. A woman should not shame her head. She is the glory of the man. And then later on in the passage, long hair on a man is his dishonor, but on a woman, it is her glory. So we see this pairing of opposites, perhaps, certainly in that last example. Her long hair is her glory, whereas it is the dishonor of the man. So dishonor and glory are being put together there. So Paul is saying that man, and by this we should understand human beings, man has only this consideration in Paul's thinking. Man is made in the image and glory of God. Paul has connected image and glory together, I think. God has made human beings to be like himself. He has given them life. He has given them existence. And I think possibly what he has in mind is the very existence of human beings brings glory to God in that we have been made like him. Our existence is due to him. So we exist as the creative, interesting, significant creatures that we are due to God's creative act, and he has made us to be like him. So in a certain sense, we are intended to reflect glory on the one who made us and the one that we are like. Now, it says the woman is the glory of the man. This is more difficult to say, but perhaps what he has in mind is that I would say that males have done nothing in themselves to deserve any particular sort of glory. But by God's design, as we see in the story, the man came first, Eve was made from him, and she was made to be his helper. The existence of the woman reflects glory on man. This person, made in God's image, made with great skill and intrinsic worth, was made to be the helper of the man. And so, by the very nature of the relationship that God has created, the woman is designed to give glory to the man. Not to go around saying, you're great, but her existence is testimony to the role that God has given the man. She is his glory. Because God didn't create Eve and make Adam from her for her sake. God made Adam and created Eve from him for his sake. That seems to be something like the argument that Paul is making. I mean, that's explicitly what he's saying. The question is, what's the significance? And perhaps it's what I'm saying here. Now, one of the questions we bump into is if something like that is the case, does this glory of the woman, that she is the man's glory, imply a prior responsibility and authority for man? Is this an issue in part of submission? Okay, there is this lack of symmetry. She is his glory in a way that he is not hers, and it is appropriate for her not to bring shame upon him, but to be his glory, and that we're talking now specifically about man and wife. But does Paul have in mind in this relationship that authority is a part of the lack of symmetry that is involved here, that the man has a certain prior responsibility and authority? Well, I have a couple of things to say about that. First of all, I don't think we should have any problem reading that into the passage if that's what Paul has in mind, because I would argue that Paul clearly has that in mind in Ephesians 5. I'm not going to go there and make that case now. But there where he says that the man is the head of the woman as Christ is the head of the church, I would say in the clearest possible way he is saying that there is a certain submission that is appropriate for the wife given the roles that God has given husband and wife to play. Now, what does that submission look like, and what would that translate into? That's a good question. But that there is that relationship seems to me to be unmistakable from Ephesians 5. I think if we were to try to explain where that authority comes from, it comes down to the issue of prior responsibility, that ultimately there is a way that a man and woman together making a family, there is a sense in which there is a responsibility for this group project that rests with the man that makes it appropriate for him ultimately to have the right to determine the direction the group goes, something like that. But we're not here to talk about Ephesians 5. We're here to talk about 1 Corinthians 11. All I want to say is, if by head in this passage and the glory that he's talking about, Paul has in mind a certain prior responsibility and authority that the man has, it would make sense that he does, because that's something that he believed. From Ephesians 5, I think that becomes clear. But is it in fact the main focus of what Paul has in mind in this section? Well, one of the things that we might point to is the phrase that immediately follows, the part I was just talking about. Therefore, the woman ought to have a symbol of authority on her head because of the angels. Now, if that's what he's saying there, that the head covering was understood to be a symbol of authority, then that pretty much settles that question for us. Paul has in mind that for the woman to remove her head covering would not just be dishonoring her husband in some way, but it is rejecting the symbol of his authority. So we need to talk about that phrase. The problem with this phrase is that it is very difficult to understand what's going on here, I think. Let me explain to you some of the problem. I feel like we have pieces that are pulling us in two different directions. One of those pieces is this fact. There are three words together here. A Greek word that means to have, this word that means authority or freedom or right. There are various ways of translating it. We'll talk about that in a minute. And then a preposition, epi, which can mean on or over. It can mean a variety of things. Now, 25 other times in the New Testament, the word have and authority, those two words, are put together in a fairly commonplace way, you know, to have authority, to have the freedom, to have the right, that kind of phrase. I have the authority to sentence you to jail. I have the authority to do this. I have the authority to do that. 25 times to have and authority are used together in that way in the New Testament. 13 other times, the phrase authority epi is used, meaning the commonsensical to have authority over, or have freedom regarding, or something like that. And there are 7 other places where all 3 of the words are used together, always to mean something like to have authority over, or to have the freedom concerning, or something like that. Do you see what I'm saying? This is a very common phrase that if it was not a question of the context here, we would immediately think, anyone reading the Greek, if you didn't have another problem to try to take care of, you would immediately think that phrase means she ought to have authority over her head, or she ought to have the right to do what she wants with her head. That's what you would understand that phrase to mean if it were not for the context in which we find ourselves. But That is by no means an insignificant consideration, because context is king, as I have said before and will say again. How do I know what a person means by the words that he uses? It's how he uses them in context. And it seems to me, when we look at this context, what we see is a structure like this. A man ought not cover his head, being the image and glory of God. But the woman is the glory of man. Let me explain that. Therefore, the woman ought to have exousia on her head. A man ought not cover his head, but the woman ought to have something on her head. And that's this word that was translated authority. When you look at that structure, it just seems really, really likely that Paul is contrasting the man ought not cover his head because he's the glory of God, but she is the glory of man, therefore she ought to have something on her head or something along those lines. The structure of the argument is such that it just seems very likely that this is the other shoe dropping. The man should not cover his head and she should, is basically what it seems like it ought to account add up to. So, this is why most translations, when you look at them, say she ought to have a symbol of authority on her head. Because it just seems so clear that he wants to say something about putting something on your head, as opposed to the man who shouldn't put something on his head. A symbol of is not there. And in fact, there's no example that we know of with where the word authority is used in this way. She ought to have authority on her head, meaning she ought to have a symbol of authority on her head. Now, does that mean it doesn't mean that? No. But it is unusual. And so we have on the one hand the fact that this is a very common phrase to mean to have authority over, and it was a very untypical phrase to mean to have a symbol of authority over. We have no precedent for anything like that. And yet, at the same time, the context seems to demand that that second phrase say something about putting something on her head. So, how do we resolve the situation? Well, one possibility is we just bite the bullet and stick in the word a symbol of authority, and we're going to make that work. That's possible. I think that is a possible way of understanding it, because the context is king. We have to take his phrase in such a way that it makes sense with the stuff around it. But it has occurred to me that there is another way of understanding what Paul's doing here. I'm sort of interested in this way of understanding it because it does a couple of things. It solves both of those problems at the same time. I'm going to propose a way that the phrase means what it typically means, and yet it fits in the context. And I'm also sort of intrigued by it because I've never read anybody else say this. So it's kind of like, ha. Now, it's probably totally wrong, but since I thought of it, and you're never going to hear it from anybody else that I know of, I might as well tell you. So I'm going to tell you. Okay. But here's what you have to picture as going on here. We have to propose that the situation is not that women are rebelliously throwing off their head covers and saying, I don't care what it says about my husband, I want everybody to see my hair, or something like that. Or, you know, to hell with my husband, I'm free, I'm on my own, or something like that. That's not what's going on. In my proposal, what's happening is that there is genuine confusion as to what ought to happen. The men culturally understand that when they're praying to God or prophesying, speaking in His name, they would remove their head coverings to show respect to God. So, but what then should the women do? If the men are doing that to show respect to God, shouldn't women have to do the same thing? Would it be appropriate for women, now Jewish women in particular, who had not been participating in the synagogue service, now are participating, are they going to get up there and when they pray, show disrespect to God? If the man is removing whatever he has on his head in order to show respect to God, shouldn't the women do the same thing? But the problem is, if they do that, it also at the same time sends a cultural signal that they are disrespecting in some ways their husband. There is something that would shame their husband if they were to remove their head covering. So they're in this spot where the men are removing their head coverings, but what should the women do? If I leave it on, it seems like I'm dishonoring God. If I take it off, I'm dishonoring my husband. Now this, I mentioned this last time, I think, something like this, and this is a proposal that Jack has made, and it makes a lot of sense to me. Okay, but now, let's think about this a little bit. Let's think about the word authority that he uses here. It can mean authority. You know, the one who has the right to dictate to you what to do, or, you know, the boss, or that sort of thing. But it's not the only thing that it means. And in 1 Corinthians, so far, every time that Paul has used this word, now this doesn't prove anything, but so far, every time that Paul has used this word, he has not used it in the sense of authority figure or something like that. He has used it in the sense of freedom or right. For instance, let me read you a couple of, he who stands firm in his own heart, or in his heart, being under no constraint, but has freedom over his own will, and has decided this in his own heart to keep his own virgin, he will do well. Another place he says, take care lest this liberty of yours or this freedom of yours somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. And then later he says, do we not have a right to eat and drink? Do we not have a right to take along a believing wife and so on? This is this word, the same word that Paul uses here, which can be translated authority. And is rightly translated authority sometimes. But in these cases, it's not so much authority as it is freedom. The right to do something, the freedom to do something. Notice in the first example, if a man is not under constraint, that is, if he doesn't lack the freedom to do otherwise, then he has freedom over his own will. That is, he is free to do differently than what he would have to do if he were under constraint. If he were under constraint, then he would have to do X. But if he has freedom over his own will, then he cannot do X. The same thing is true with the Corinthians. There is this idea that there is a religious obligation not to eat meat sacrificed to idols. But they believe, and Paul agrees, that they have a freedom to ignore this restriction. They are free with regard to this, and they can eat the meat sacrificed to idols. So, my proposal would be something like this. And again, is this what he's saying? It's difficult to say, but anyway, here's my proposal. Man, as he describes it, is under obligation to honor God, who is his glory. And in the culture, man is under obligation not to send the cultural signal that would dishonor God. So man has an obligation. He has no freedom in this regard. He needs to take his head covering off in this situation because to do otherwise in that culture would communicate disrespect for the God that he is appealing to. The woman, however, is the glory of man, in particular her husband, and to remove her head covering would dishonor him. Therefore, Paul is saying she is free from the obligation to uncover her head. Man ought to uncover his head when he prays, but the woman ought to have the freedom to disregard this. Not the freedom to do whatever she wants, but the freedom from the obligation to cover her head so that she can keep her head covered and honor her husband. Now, every way of understanding verse 10 is somewhat labored and requires explanation. I mean, no matter what you do, you have to come up with some explanation for how it's fitting together. And mine has that same quality of being a little labored and you have to explain it in order to make it work. The reason I'm intrigued by it as a possibility is that it resolves the pull of those two pieces. It retains the idea, though it's basically saying, the woman ought to have freedom concerning her head, freedom over her head, the right to disregard this obligation that the man has, which would be a common way of using that phrase. But at the same time, then, the sentence ends up essentially meaning she ought to cover her head. He has the obligation to uncover, but she has the freedom to keep it on and not dishonor her husband. So in the context, then, the sense of the phrase would end up fitting into the context in a way that seems to me to be fitting. So is that what's happening there? I don't know. And maybe I haven't even explained it in such a way that you can follow what I'm getting at. It comes down to this. At this point, am I convinced that Paul has explicitly appealed to the authority of the husband in this context? That he's saying you ought to have a symbol of authority, she ought to have a symbol of authority on her head? Well, it's possible, and I can understand why people go in that direction. The proposal that I have made preserves the idea that she has an obligation to not shame her husband because she was created to be his glory. But it does not necessarily push the idea that the key issue is authority. What then, I mean, I'm in a spot at this point where there are certainly other things that would be good to talk about in the passage, but there's a lot of different ones to talk about, and I would like to leave us some time to talk about this together a little bit. So let me just tell you where I find myself as I look at this situation. I find myself seeing in the Genesis story clearly the equality of man and woman made in the image of God, alike human beings, different from the animals. I also see in the Genesis story what Paul is talking about. There is this phenomenon that we have a story of the man being created first and the woman being created to be his helper, and that seems to be the source of the lack of symmetry that Paul is appealing to. In the cultural situation, he's not just saying the woman should keep her head covering on because it would dishonor her husband, and we should never dishonor the person we're married to. His argument doesn't just seem to be, and if the cultural situation were such that the man would be dishonoring his wife, he shouldn't do it either. He seems to be arguing that there is something that is true for her that is not true for him. She is his glory in a way that he is not hers. When you connect that with the sort of argument that he makes in Ephesians about the authority of the man, and the 1 Timothy passage where he talks about the woman being made second and not, that's a passage that talks about teaching and that sort of thing. It seems as if Paul has an idea that something in the creation account implies that there is a certain priority that the man has. And I admit at this point, I am hard-pressed to specifically articulate how that works. It seems to me that Ephesians 5 tells us that there is a prior responsibility that the man has that leads to a call to a certain sort of submission, and I don't have any problem with that if that's what he's saying, and that does seem to be what he's saying. The idea that the Genesis story tells us of a certain priority that the man has, that seems clear to me, but the nature of that priority, when you start to try to pin it down, it gets a little fuzzy. And the best I can do is to say, it seems to me that God has made things such that in this life, a man and a woman come together to be husband and wife, with the husband having a certain priority in determining the nature of the project that they have come together to do. I think, I mean, it's very difficult to pin it down, but it seems to me that it is no accident. It is not just male brutality that has ended up manifesting itself in the world so often as men and women coming together in marriage with the man setting the agenda in a certain way for the the life project that they take on together. It's not just a cultural phenomenon that men have, they're stronger and the culture lets them get their way and so they walk all over their wives. Although it happens, it very definitely happens. And that's part of the reason that the notion of headship has gotten such a bad name, because in the name of it, great evils have been justified. But I think that Paul is seeing in the Genesis story just a theological confirmation of something that we recognize in life, that men and women tend to come together in a certain way. That's the best I can do in trying to understand how Paul would put this picture together. For myself, I mean, let me just be honest. As I think about my own marriage and how my life has worked itself out, when you come to the question of authority and prior responsibility and that sort of thing, I believe in that authority that Paul talks about. I think he is suggesting such a thing. But in practice, it just doesn't come out that way. I mean, we just don't relate to each other in such a way. I mean, I'm not sure it's ever happened in the entire history of our marriage that we have disagreed and I have put my foot down and said, but I'm the head, so we have to do it this way. Has it ever happened? I'm not sure that it's ever happened. But at the same time, when you look at the life project that Robbie and I have taken together, there's no question that I have played a larger role in kind of setting the agenda, and I'm not embarrassed by that fact. I don't feel like a bully in that fact. It seems to me that there's something that's natural and appropriate about that. Now, at the same time, my wife has played a large role in setting the nature of the relationship and how we pursue things, because she is my helper, and she's very good at all kinds of stuff. But how I think about this in my own life is, if it ever came to it, I would be willing to say to Robbie, I think this is my responsibility to make this decision, and I think that this is the way we ought to go. But what it means more is the fact that if some egalitarian was to come to me and say, aren't you ashamed of the fact that your wife is helping your career to come together in a certain way instead of you helping her career to come together in a certain way, I think I would say, no, I'm not embarrassed by that. That's how it would work out for me as I think about how the sort of thing that Paul is saying here. Okay, so let me throw it to you then. Obviously, you put together the 3 weeks that I have talked about this. You can see that I have a lot of questions, and I'm not here to assert anything dogmatically, but I have thought about this a lot. I don't know when I have worked as hard on kind of hammering on a passage as I have been for the last month on this passage. I'm just finishing a paper that I am on this passage that I'm submitting for a class that I'm doing. That's part of the reason I've been working on it so hard, is I wanted to get ready for this teaching and I wanted to get ready for this paper. And as it was, I mean, I've been hammering on this for a month and I'm only just getting to the point where some things sort of seem clear to me and I still have a lot of questions. So all that effort for so little, but now's your opportunity to set me straight. Go ahead, Logan.
A couple of detailed questions here, but first a comment. I'm single, so this doesn't really scare me as much as it may irritate others. It strikes me that what you're talking about are the implications of this, but not necessarily the clear teaching of this.
Right.
Because Paul doesn't seem to be talking about how to get along in your marriage as much as he's talking about how to behave in a church service.
Right. The question is, why did he appeals to Genesis to say, this is why you ought to respect this cultural tradition and do your hair a certain way. But the question is, what implications does that Genesis passage have for any other situations that I might find myself in? Yes.
And the helper in Genesis, there was not found a helper. Is that Adam's helper or God's helper?
Adam's helper.
Definitely?
Well,
if we change that to worker
well,
or doer...
The word means helper, one who assists. But yes, I mean, ultimately we can say assists in what sense? And then, I mean, we could say a worker or whatever you want, whatever you think fits best the context. But the idea is an assistant, someone to help.
Okay. The use of the term glory here.
Yes.
You know, it's how do you pin that down, the definition of glory?
Right.
Because man is both the image and the glory of God, he says, but woman is only the glory of the man. So is he making a distinction there between the man's responsibility and the woman's responsibility? And how is he using the term glory? Because last time I asked this question, a teacher said, well, the legions were the glory of Rome.
Uh-huh.
So that's how that word was used. And I go, well, that clears it up.
Okay. You know? Well, the problem is that the word glory can be used in a variety of ways. Its old use, if I'm remembering correctly, is this right, Jack? In Greek, it started with the idea of reputation. Isn't that the original? But in the Septuagint, it gets used to refer to the glory, you know, like the glory of God, you know, the shining glory and that kind of thing. This is the right word that I'm thinking about here. Isn't it? Yeah, okay. So the word can be used in the sense of glory as in bright, you know, the glory of the light shown about them and that kind of stuff. Or if something has glory, it can be an intrinsic glory, something that it is glorious in the sense that it has a quality that recommends it. You look at it and say, wow, there's something great about that. But it could be any number of qualities that word could refer to. And then if I'm someone's glory, that's where the legions were the glory of Rome kind of thing comes into it. I'm someone else's glory. That means something about me brings glory, brings honor, brings a high reputation or something like that to someone else. So Paul doesn't give any explanation here for why man is God's glory and why woman is his glory. Well, he does. He explains why woman is man's glory because she was made from him and on his account. That's why she's his glory. So I'm looking at two pieces. He connects image and glory together. And I'm thinking that wasn't an accident, but that image contributes to the reason he would say that we're the glory of God. And it is the Genesis story that tells us that the woman is the glory of man, and I'm trying to understand from that, how does that end up being the case? It's two very different ways, because it's kind of a direct glory on God. Human beings glorify God because God is responsible for them and has made them in his image and so on, I think. Whereas the man is not glorified by the wife because he's responsible for her or made her what she is or anything like that, but it is in the nature of the way God has made things that the man is blessed to be in the position where the woman is his glory. And that's why, that's how I'm putting those things together. But yeah, glory is very tough. Paul uses, all of the passages where Paul uses glory drive me up the wall. Because they're so important, and yet it's difficult to pin down exactly what he's saying. We boast in hope of the glory of God. What an important statement that is. What does that mean exactly? That's very tricky. And I've banged my head on that one a number of times, too. So,
And who are the angels in 10?
what a sadist you are. Up here. Take it here, Ron, and now over here. I have no idea what the angels are in that passage. Someday Jack is going to convince me that the word angels, which means messengers, basically, can also function as a noun that means messages. This is what that Jack argues in several passages. There are several passages where it's difficult to know what angels are doing there, and Jack proposes that it means something different. And as it usually is with Jack and me, Jack comes with some, I was going to say harebrained, but, you know, some unusual proposal for something or another, and I drag my feet and say, I can't see that. I don't see what the evidence is for that. So I'm not convinced that that's the case. I think we're left with angels. But, you know, I usually lag a couple of years behind, so ask me in a couple of years, and I'm sure Jack will have worn me down, and I'll be believing in that, too. But who knows? I did this time. I went through, I looked at all the passages in the Bible where angels are mentioned and try to sort of get, you know, a feel for what might be involved in this. Every proposal that I am aware of for what it means is unsatisfying. It makes me wonder whether there wasn't something about the way, I mean, when you run into something like this, one possibility is that there's something about the way they asked the question that evoked that response. You know, that they said, you know, well, someone's saying, well, we think that the angels are witnessing our worship service, and we think it's entirely inappropriate for the women to dishonor God by not taking something off of their heads. You know, for the sake of the angels who are watching, you know, it's not just us here. It's not just human beings who are watching this and offended by the women taking their heads off. This is supernatural business we're on here. And so it's because of the angels that the women ought to uncover their heads, someone would argue. And so Paul just tacks it on in his refutation of that, if my way of understanding it would be right. Then basically what he would be saying is, you know, no, I think men, that women ought to honor, they ought to have the symbol on that recognizes that they respect the way God has made the man and the woman to relate to each other because of the angels. Something like that. Well, okay, who's to say? That in that case then, Paul doesn't really care about angels, he's just dealing with something they brought up. Is that true? I have no idea. Who could say? And I don't know. But ultimately, we come to that question here with a number of things in this passage as well. The best we can do is try to put it together in a way that it makes sense, and it's a challenge. It's a short passage, and it has a lot of questions in it. So, anything else? Yeah.
This is really just a comment, and maybe I'm the only one that was struck by this, but one of the things that I really like about your interpretation in dealing with the word that's translated authority and whether, you know, it should be freedom, is that it kind of struck me how much I'm influenced when I come to this passage by just the culture that I live in and the issues that we have. And I think because of all the issues around things like headship and all the abuse and the misuse and all the, you know, the pressures that we have on us to see, you know, to say, well, you know, Paul really means this, or, you know, this is, you know, that the issue really is this or that, when in fact it may have been something very different. For me, what I was struck with is how much I've kind of assumed that, well, obviously the issue is that there are women in the church that are really wanting to have some freedom here. They want to take off their head coverings. They feel kind of oppressed by the culture and all that stuff. Finally, Christianity comes along and they can say, I don't have to be bound by those things anymore. I have freedom. And I think in your interpretation, I was kind of struck by, no, actually, maybe in fact the issue is that you have women who are feeling really uncomfortable with the fact that that they feel maybe they need to take the head covering off, or there are some people that are pressuring them to do that. And they've lived their whole life that way. Maybe they've been married for many, many years, and they've never once taken their head covering off in public. They feel very, very mm-hmm. strongly about it, and now there's kind of an appeal to Paul, you know, solve this for us because I don't want to do this. I don't want to take the head covering off. In my eyes, traditionally, I would be thinking, doesn't that seem like this oppressive thing? Women have to wear head coverings. They have to, you know, do all this and
where we've got the freedom to not do that. But I think in the context of that culture,
yes,
the women are saying, I really would like to have the freedom to keep this on and not feel like I'm dishonoring God or doing something inappropriate in this church.
Right.
And I think that that your interpretation kind of opened my eyes a little bit to that.
Yeah, if I'm right, which I may not be, but if I'm right in putting it together that way, that's exactly the point, is the freedom is running the other way. Not the freedom to do away with this, but the freedom to keep it on. And the pressure is a religious pressure. You know, don't you need to ritually show your respect to God here in this situation? And Paul's basically saying, God's the one who made you to be a woman who is a wife in this situation. He's not going to be bothered by the fact that you're showing respect to your husband by keeping your head covering on. So, yeah, that's a good point. You understand, if I'm wrong about the way I put that together, then that's not what's happening here. But I like it, at least. See, that's another thing that's true about me. I have to think about it for a while. I propose it, and I think about it, and I'm not saying that Jack is going to jump in and agree with this, but it has happened in the past that I've proposed something tentatively, and then Jack says, hey, that's great, and he starts running with it, and it takes me a year to decide to agree with myself. So that's how conservative I am. Go ahead.
I have one, Ron. I'm using the NASB version.
Over here.
I'm over here. And the term symbol of authority in verse 10 is italicized, or
right,
symbol of, actually.
Right.
That means it was added?
Right.
Okay.
Exactly, yeah. In so many translations...
That's a translation on their part.
Yes.
I mean, that's an interpretation on their part, then.
Right.
All right.
Right. Yeah. I'm saying that this is either a phrase that means she ought to have authority over her head, or she ought to have the right to do what she wants with her head, or freedom concerning her head, or else... it's she ought to have authority on her head. And then the idea would be that, well, what does it mean to have authority on your head? It's to have her head covering on her head, so the head covering must be a symbol of authority, is the way they are understanding it. And contextually, either one of those would work. And I'm just saying, part of what I like about my new proposal is that it solves both of my problems. So.
And the term on is...
it could be on or over. It's this preposition. It's one of those prepositions in Greek that's used a lot of different ways. There are examples of it being used to talk about something epi your head, on your head. But there are many examples, like I said, of it being used authority over or freedom concerning or something like that. So it's genuinely ambiguous. And New American Standard has put in a symbol of in order to say, here's how we're resolving the ambiguity.
The other thing I had about verse 10 was Logan's question with the way the sentence is structured. He starts by saying, therefore, and then because. Almost like,
right,
this is the biggest part of this verse.
Uh-huh.
This is the point I'm trying to make. Therefore, do this because of the angels. Do you see, is that really the strength of this verse?
Well, I would put it the other way. I would put the strength of it not on the because of the angels, but the connection to what came before. That is, man ought not do this because he's the glory of God. Woman is the glory of man on account of that, on account of the fact that she's the glory of man. She ought to do this thing on account of the angels. And on account of the angels is thrown in as another qualifying statement, but he's already made his first statement of why she should do this. I mean, the argument follows right through. It's on account of what I just said that she ought to do this, on account of the angels. You know, and why both of those things? Well, it all comes back to this angel bit again, and I don't know. Okay, maybe one more question, and then we should stop, probably.
Getting back to the... my turn here. Getting back to the surface question on the head covering itself, we know there's a lot of segments within the Christian church where they actually use head covering, little doilies or whatever. Does it make sense for people to interpret it that they really ought to be wearing their head covering? Is that a valid... I mean, people,
yeah,
that really have a heart for wanting to do what God wants them to do, does it,
right,
would it make sense to interpret it this way? where they
well,
can actually do that.
It would make sense for them to do it if they understand that that's what it's calling them to do, certainly.
Presumably they would.
Right. Now, there are two, okay. Let's take R.C. Sproul, for example. R.C. Sproul, I believe, last I checked, believes that this is not a culturally relative command, but his argument is, look, Paul is appealing to creation, so this is not culturally relative. This is all men ought to pray with their head uncovered in all cultures, and all women ought to pray with their heads covered in all cultures, because Paul is appealing to creation. Okay, my response to that argument is, well, in the context, what he is clearly appealing to creation to demonstrate is that woman is the glory of man is the head of the woman, and therefore she should not dishonor him. I think that's clearly what he's appealing to creation to demonstrate. It is not clear that the further argument, and in order not to shame him, she should keep her head covering on, it's not clear in the passage that is derived from creation as well. So Sproul's argument that it's transcultural, I'm saying, well, it's half transcultural at least. A woman acknowledging the relationship to her husband is transcultural, but there's nothing in the passage that says that head coverings are transcultural. Sproul's second argument is that if there's a question in my mind whether I ought to do it or not, which is better, to do it and risk having one more rule that I didn't actually need to have, or not do it and disobey God? And that sounds like a weighty argument. In fact, he concludes his argument by saying, I hope it's obvious which you ought to do. And I feel terrible when I read that, because it is not obvious to me which of those you ought to do. In fact, I would argue that you could make a case just strongly the other way, that the Bible makes it clear that the virtue in obeying commands is, yes, it is an attitude of obedience, but it is also a submission to the reality that God is embodying in those commands. The Pharisees were not commended. I mean, you could say, look, we're putting a hedge around the law to make sure that we don't disobey anything that God said. Jesus didn't say, good job. He said, the problem is, yeah, you've obeyed those things, but you don't know what they're about. You have violated what you ought to have known about God and what he wants. So when I come to something like this, I have to say to myself, I cannot explain to myself, I cannot find, how would I, by looking at the creation story, decide that all men should have their head uncovered when they pray to God, and that all women ought to have their head covered when they pray to God. I can't understand what principle or how I would have gotten to that spot. So for me, I'm saying, since I can't see how that would be, and I can understand how the culture might have dictated such a thing, and his appeal to Genesis is only clearly to say that the woman ought to honor her husband, and not necessarily to say, and always it's head coverings that's the issue, I put that together and say the thing that makes the most sense is not to. But if somebody read one of those things differently, if they could understand how it could be rooted in creation, or they don't think that the culture could be contributing to it, or they just, you know, I think they ought to obey it. But it would be like one of those situations. It would be exactly like what Paul's talking about in Romans 14 and 15, that situation where someone thinks that you can eat everything, including meat, and some think you can only eat vegetables. And both of them are doing it because they think it is obedient to God. I think that's the attitude we ought to have. I should not look down on the person who does it because they're doing it out of obedience, and they should not look with contempt upon me for being disobedient because I don't think it's what it's saying to do. That would be exactly equivalent, I think. Okay, so I should stop there. Thanks. I appreciate your patience. I know this has not been the most satisfying set of teaching I've ever done, but I hope it's at least helpful a little bit in trying to sort this stuff out.